Creo que vamos a darle inicio a esto porque ya vamos un poquito tarde. ¿Me estás oyendo? Me avisan si hay algún tipo de problema con esto, pero creo que me están oyendo. Que le suban un poquito, que no le va. Bueno, bien. Pues gracias a ustedes por asistir. La sesión que van a ver a continuación es una conversación entre un tipo que tiene un perro y que es profesor universitario en Bogotá, que soy yo. Hola. Hola.
Bien, bien. Ahora bien.
¿Ahí me oyen? Probando. Hola, Cartagena. Uy, siempre quise decir eso, es like a rockstar, ¿no? Ok, bueno, soy un profesor universitario que tiene un perro y que le gusta salir con juguetitos. No es este tipo de profesor universitario, efectivamente. Este es un amigo que afortunadamente ya se ha pasado los libros electrónicos y los libros electrónicos ayudan bastante este problema de la mano que no da para llevar tanto texto. Pero igual, cuando uno está en una ciudad como Cartagena, encuentra sitios en donde hay ventas de libros tradicionales que son bellísimos y que ni David ni yo, luego de haber hablado bastante, estamos pensando que se van a desaparecer. Ahora bien, el invitado central es este señor que se llama David Eagleman. David, ahí estaba siendo entrevistado y le estaban pidiendo que si por favor hacía un mapa mental de lo que él tenía en la cabeza. David es esta mitad y es esta otra mitad, que esa es su muy reciente esposa, que también al parecer es tan pirata del Caribe como nosotros. El caso es que el artículo que algunos de ustedes leyeron, que está publicado acá, dice que Pablo Francisco Arrieta bajó 3 libros en preparación a la charla con David, 2 de los cuales los pagó y 1 se lo bajó por ahí. Efectivamente, son 3 libros de los cuales 2 estaban a la venta y yo podría comprar. Y el tercero no se podía comprar, así es que lo conseguí. En Amazon uno entra y puede comprar los libros. Esta es la página de David en Amazon. Y lo que es interesante es la biografía. I'm a neuroscientist during the day and a fiction writer at night. As a result of a positive reception for some, I've been writing many of my science manuscripts this year in a comfortable chair 30,000 feet above the surface of the planet. O el tipo es un astronauta, o estamos hablando de alguien cuya UZ es un avión, que es lo que está pasando en este momento con muchos de nosotros. Ahora bien, él escribe libros tradicionales que pueden ser leídos en máquinas como el iPad. Esta es mi sección de libros, y ahí yo tengo uno de sus libros. Este es Some, que ustedes de pronto lo oyeron. Uno puede subrayar dentro de estos libros electrónicos exactamente igual. Y hay una cosa muy bonita que no sé si David conoce, que es que existe algo que se llama los Popular Highlights. Y los Popular Highlights lo que me permiten es no solamente ver mis notas, sino verlas de otras personas. Entonces, con esto, el libro que ustedes tienen en la mano se convierte también en una ayuda para uno como lector, porque lo guía por lo que otros lectores consideran, pero yo creo que también para los autores, porque un autor nunca sabía qué subrayaban en sus libros. En cambio ahora, él sí lo puede ver. Evidentemente, lo traen acá al High Festival y aquí está parado, porque ayer estuvo más o menos como en un púlpito, mientras le tomaban fotografías y hablaba de las vidas después de la vida. Pero desgraciadamente los que se lo perdieron, eso fue ayer. Hoy vamos a estar hablando de otra cosa. Pero ayer, mientras él iba leyendo, yo iba siguiendo el libro en mi aparatito, en mi iPad. Ahora bien, por el otro lado, él tiene algo que se llama una aplicación, un libro aplicación. Dentro de eso, ya hay otros que lo han hecho, como Tashen. De hecho, el libro de David yo lo compré el mismo día que salió este de Tashen. Este es un libro de arquitectura, cuesta $40. Si lo consiguiéramos en Colombia, que no pasa, y cuesta $8.99, y lo compré el mismo día que Benedict Tashen lo lanzó en Londres. Esa es la magia que tiene esto. Inmediatamente me compré un libro de un tal David Eagleman, editado por una editorial llamada Canongate. Es una aplicación. Yo lo estaba leyendo y como somos pioneros, los lectores de estos libros electrónicos y demás, yo lo que hice fue que lo tuiteé. Tuitear quiere decir que lo mandé a mis redes y lo hice a través de una herramienta. Cuando lo tuiteo me doy cuenta que David decía, "Hello Colombia, I'm going to the Hay Festival." Y yo como así. Y el tipo venía para acá, el escritor del libro que yo acababa de comprar. ¿Qué hago inmediatamente? Esto es una infidencia, pero a mí me habían invitado y luego me desinvitaron porque iba a hablar de un tema, pero la persona dijo, no quiero tocar ese tema, periodismo digital, tan digital, no tanto, quiero periodismo. Y cuando yo tuiteo, "Hello David, welcome to Colombia and to Hay Festival," a la gente del Hay se le prendió un bombillito y dijo, ¿y por qué no los sentamos en el mismo escenario y habla el lector con su autor? Y efectivamente eso es lo que están viendo. El resultado de que yo esté acá es porque lo tuiteé desde Bogotá. Y ahí está el evento que toda la gente pudo ver. Y este es el libro. Cuando uno abre el libro, uno se encuentra con un texto que ya no tiene página 1, 2, 3 y 4, sino que uno lo puede navegar de esta manera. El libro se llama Why the Net Matters, How the Internet Will Save Civilization. Y no hay un orden obligatorio para seguir el tema. De hecho, como estamos acá con David, vamos a ir arrancando páginas y vamos a dejar que el autor expanda. So, this moment I'm going to start speaking in English for you to understand what I'm saying. So, welcome David, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. And let's begin with this. You, in your book, you talk about six special things that the web is very good at, and that is going to prevent civilization from going under. So,
well, thank you, Pablo, and welcome everyone. Yeah, in this book, what I'm addressing is I looked at previous civilizations and the reasons that they collapsed. I mean, when you're in the middle of a thriving civilization, it seems impossible that it could all fall apart. But of course, if you had lived in any of these previous civilizations, you would have thought the same thing. And of course, in this part of the world, there are the Aztecs and the Mayans and so on, all of which collapsed as a civilization. So, if you look at the reasons why different societies have collapsed, you find that there are essentially six different reasons for it. And these have to do with things like epidemics and natural disasters. But sometimes they have to do with things like losing information, not being able to hold on to information. And sometimes they have to do with things like tyranny, with bad governments. And sometimes they have to do with running out of energy or resources. So if you look at all the reasons why civilizations have collapsed, what becomes clear is that the internet actually addresses all of these, muchas gracias, addresses all of these with a sort of natural ease. I mean, this wasn't the reason for the invention of the internet, but it turns out that all of the major fatal diseases for civilizations are addressed by the invention of the internet. I guess we could take this one as an example. So the Library of Alexandria was the place that had all of the world's learning, because everybody who passed through this port city, their manuscripts were taken and copied. So the library built up the world's largest collection of knowledge. And what happened is Julius Caesar, in a battle with Ptolemy, ended up burning down the library accidentally. But the world's knowledge disappeared like that. This has important ramifications. It turns out it's very important to hold on to knowledge, because sometimes this is the sort of thing that's very important. For example, inoculation against smallpox is something that was reinvented over and over in history because nobody knew that it existed in different parts of the planet. So in the Western world, we think of inoculation as something that Lady Montague introduced in England, and then later Edward Jenner improved upon with vaccination against smallpox. But in fact, that had been going on for hundreds of years in other parts of the world. And of course, if the Native American civilizations here had known about that, that would have changed everything. 90% of the population here died of smallpox. So the point is, the internet addresses this with a natural ease, because there's redundancy of information, and it moves at the speed of light. And so now, all of the world's information is accessible at the fingertips, and that makes a big difference.
And it's funny because this is just a big conversation, what we're having right now, all over the world. For example, before coming to Cartagena, I met this fine gentleman, and his name is Joe Broderick, who's an actor. And when he talked to me, he said, "What are you doing in High Festival?" And I said, "I'm going to speak with Mr. Eagleman about his new book, How the Internet Will Save Civilization." So he told me, "Oh, that reminds me of a very interesting book called How the Irish Saved Civilization," which is beautiful because it's a book about the location that the Irish had and how they collected all the remainings of the Roman Empire. So right now, the Irish could be anywhere. As a matter of fact, I'm half Irish, so I'm one of them. Maybe you're another one. And this morning, we were having this conversation with Maria Jimena Duzan, the journalist. And if you're noticing here, I have documents in video of both conversations, him and his and hers. So the beauty of this is I can share this with the world, and this conversation that these two people had, it's going to spread all over the world. I was trying to explain, Joe, what Twitter was. Obviously, I'm not talking about age, and we're not talking about age. This gentleman was looking at a Man Ray exhibition in Bogota a couple days ago. And if you look at him, he has a very nice camera, and he was taking pictures. Afterwards, he was uploading everything to the web. And it's a question of, as Fito Páez, the singer from Argentina, says, attitude. Es una cuestión de actitud. So let's go to another subject, which is outpacing disaster.
Yeah, so something that has, of course, brought down a number of civilizations is natural disasters like earthquakes or tsunamis or fires. And we're not able to stop those, but what the internet gives now is an opportunity to move faster than the natural disaster. So a beautiful example of this was seen with the California wildfires in 2007. The media, the television crews were covering mostly the mansions of celebrities, and that was the stuff that was sort of the most newsworthy. But of course, what the people in California wanted to know is, where is the fire? Is it coming towards my neighborhood? Do I need to get out of here? So what happened is you could witness this shift where people stopped watching the television and they were tweeting, they were taking pictures with their cell phone, geotagged pictures, they were posting on Facebook, and so on. And as a result, because there were journalists on every block in every neighborhood, the news spread much faster than the fire, and it spread much faster than the news agencies could have possibly covered themselves. So in this way, the news about the disaster was moving fast. And there's a very important example of this besides the wildfires, which is, oh, I see you have a slide,
yeah.
Which is what happened in 2004 with the Indian Ocean tsunami. So, of course, what happened is there was an underwater earthquake off the coast of Sumatra, and this caused an enormous wave, and nobody knew that it was coming. And so, as we know, of course, the water started to recede all around the Indian Ocean, and everybody thought that was really neat, and they went out into the water, and thousands of people lost their lives because of this. Now, contrast this with what happened in the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean has a tsunami warning system in place. So there are a bunch of buoys that are along in the water, all across the water, and when there are disturbances, these transmit their signals at the speed of electrons, and they serve as a warning system that out in the middle of the ocean, a great wave is heading towards the land. So just, I guess this was about 10 months ago now, there was a disturbance in the Pacific Ocean, and everybody in Hawaii was warned. Everybody got off of the beaches and to high land. All of the ships there went out into the water so they wouldn't be hit against the shore. And as it turns out, the tsunami didn't hit, but it was a beautiful example of how quickly the information could get somewhere. And so if you contrast what happened in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, you get a clear example of the importance of spreading information very quickly.
And there's another thing, because you always complain that your kids are always online, always sending messages, and they even go to the beach with their messages and their machines. So who was the only one that knew about the tsunami before?
There was a 10-year-old British girl who was able to save like 100 people on the beach because she had learned in her class that when the water recedes, that means there's a tsunami coming. So that was the only place where somebody was saved as a result.
So the girl was there.
Yeah.
There's also another problem, which is tyranny. Some governments could be very mean to their people. So what happens with the internet?
Right. So something that's traditionally happened, just in the 20th century, we have so many examples of governments who are blocking the free flow of information. So, for example, in the former Soviet Union, the newspapers were tightly controlled. The copy machines, the Xerox machines, were tightly controlled. Even the weather reports were doctored so that, because at the extremes of weather, if it's too hot or too cold, then the workers don't have to work. And so Stalin made sure that the weather reports never said it was too hot or too cold. So, and this happened not only in USSR, but in Ceausescu's Romania and in China. And this happens all over with tyrannical regimes. What the net does is it makes that impossible. It makes censorship extremely difficult, because it's so easy to find the information of the world. Now, of course, a lot of the information on the web is biased, but at least the opportunity is there for us to find the bloggers of the world, the newspapers of the world, the television broadcasts of the world, and make our own decisions about what we're seeing out there. And that makes an enormous difference in terms of a government's capacity to control the information that the constituents are getting. And I'll just mention one other thing. You probably know that China tries to tightly control what goes in and out of there. It's called the Great Firewall of China. But it turns out that the young people in China, every day, they set up what's called a proxy server connection into Hong Kong, and they're surfing the web. It turns out that there are large holes in the Great Firewall of China. It's very easy to circumvent this, and that's probably the most sophisticated firewall of any government in the world. And the point is, it's easy to sidestep governments with this nowadays.
And it's funny, because it's not only big governments the one that try to censor things. What's the Streisand effect?
So a few years ago, somebody took a picture of Barbara Streisand, the actress and singer. Somebody took a picture of her mansion, and they posted it online. And Barbara Streisand got mad about it and said, "You have to take it offline." And so what happened is, the moment she said that, the moment she tried to suppress the information, it exploded. It went all over the place, because everybody on the web, or the whole community on the web, doesn't like censorship. And so everybody put it up on their sites. And this is now named the Streisand effect. And the general story is, the more you try to suppress important information, the more that people will put it up immediately. And of course, we've seen this with WikiLeaks. As soon as various companies or governments made noises about suppressing WikiLeaks, everybody started mirroring the site. They started putting up copies of the site and the information as quickly as they could. So it means it's impossible to suppress now.
So maybe this image that is familiar to all of us is going to disappear soon. This is the lady in front of my hotel this morning, and she got the newspaper, and she was reading it. But obviously, David just mentioned a new way to get the news, which is WikiLeaks and things where you are part of the system that is giving the news to the rest of the people. So there's a beautiful example of journalism or reporting made by citizens, and that is...
Yeah, it turns out that one of the most important issues that faces a lot of countries is that the voting is not free. It's tampered by with the government or with gangs who are serving one of the candidates, things like that. And so what we've seen in probably a dozen countries now is this ability to report on how the voting is going with cell phones. So citizens everywhere around the world, when they go to vote, they report on their cell phone to a central site, hey, there's intimidation here, or there's vote tampering, or things are fine here. And as a result, there's sort of a journalistic spotlight on all the places where something bad is happening, and journalists can go to that spot and expose it. And that makes a huge difference. It makes voting much more clean and transparent because journalists don't know all the spots to cover. They need to hear from the people on the ground. And now, with cell phone technology being so cheap and ubiquitous, it's a piece of cake to do that.
And the thing that is great is that he talks about a system called Ushahidi, which is a platform where people can report anything based or doing it with a cell phone. So that means that the new reports can come from any of these places. And this is an image that is completely alien for David and his wife. This is one guy selling minutes. This is very poetic. In Colombia, you can go and buy minutes for your time, for your afterlife. In your afterlife, you end up in Cartagena buying minutes. But then the thing is that this guy has 5 different cell phones. So if you want to report something and become anonymous, you can do it with this. And this is a thing that nobody thought. So I can make a wiki leak based with a cell phone from the street. So this is something to take care about. And obviously, what you're going to see, something that David shows in his book and that you maybe haven't seen before, this is China's view of Google in one subject.
Okay, so this is, if on the left here, if you're in China and you Google Tiananmen Square, what you find are a number of beautiful pictures of Tiananmen Square. If you're outside of China and you Google Tiananmen, what you find are the images of the protests there. But what this means is that within China, there's there's real censorship of what's going on. And as many of you probably know, Google agreed with China a couple of years ago that they would allow censorship of search results. Why? Because for Google, it's 400 million active internet users. It's a huge market to tap into. It's bigger than the entire United States. So Google wanted very much to be inside China, and they agreed to this. But what happened some months ago is that there were some break-ins. There was hacking into the Google servers in China, and that made Google very mad. And they said, you know what, forget it. We're pulling out of China, and we're not going to allow censorship there anymore. So this is a very important move that a company like Google is willing to give up some of their revenue in order to stand against censorship. I mean, they didn't at first, but now they're moving that way. And that's very important. And I think it's important on us to support companies who stand against censorship.
And there's also this image.
Yeah, this is an image from the book about what's happening in the world in terms of censorship here, where the darker the color, the more problematic the censorship. Or in other words, how much the flow of information is not a free flow of information. And it turns out that there are a lot of trouble spots to worry about. And in fact, this map, I need to update this because Australia, it turns out, is now, there is legislation that is being considered in Australia to do what's called blacklisting of certain sites, which means that at the internet provider level, there are certain sites that won't be accessible anymore. And that's true in a lot of other countries. But we wouldn't expect that in a place like Australia, in a democracy. And so, but you know, this is really being considered there. And we just have to watch out for this. It requires vigilance on all of our parts to not let that happen.
And you have to update it because Venezuela is blue, and I think now it's closer to other places. I just think. Obviously, this is another image that is very striking because it's energy. And this is North America, this is New York, where everything is shiny and bright with lights. And then you have this story about resources.
Yeah, it turns out one of the main reasons that civilizations fall is because they run out of energy. This is known as carrying capacity, which is a term that means what do the resources of the region allow in terms of how much energy do you have? How much energy can you spend? And what has happened over and over in history is that civilizations start using too much energy and they run out, and then they end up in collapse. Well, of course, the concern for all of us nowadays is with fossil fuels running out of oil and petroleum. And what is beautiful about what has happened with the internet is that it naturally has provided enormous energy savings. So, for example, when is the last time that you bought a CD, right? You don't buy CDs now, you download music automatically. Well, it turns out that matters. That saves billions of pounds of carbon dioxide and fuel costs, because what you're doing now is you're moving bits, not atoms. You're just moving the information around. You're not having to make physical devices and carry them around from place to place. And of course, when you look at what's happened with newspapers and magazines and blogging and online news sites and things like this, it becomes clear that we're saving billions of pounds of paper and pollution and things like this. And even when it comes to online shopping, e-commerce, that saves so much money because you don't have to drive around town everywhere now. Instead, you surf around for 5 minutes, you find what you want, you click on it, and it comes to your door. Now, you might say, well, it still requires delivery trucks. But it turns out people have calculated these costs. The delivery trucks are so much more efficient than you driving around from place to place. Just as one example, I don't know how many of you have noticed this or know this, but do you have UPS here? Is it called the same thing, UPS?
It's FedEx or, yeah.
Okay. Well, UPS doesn't make left turns anymore. They only turn right. Why? Because it turns out that making a left turn is very inefficient, because you have to wait at the light, you wait for a long time, you idle your engine, and then you make your left turn. It's more efficient to make three rights. And so UPS has these optimizing algorithms, these programs for making their routes maximally efficient. And they can figure out how to deliver a series of packages with the most efficiency. So it turns out that online shopping is, you know, saving the environment. And so it's been a terrific benefit for the world that the internet saves so much energy sort of accidentally. And the last thing I'll say is you can calculate this just by looking at the amount of energy expended per dollar of gross domestic product. In other words, how much is the society producing and how much energy are they using per dollar of production? And that number has been dropping and dropping dramatically. It's gone down 20% just in the last 5 years or so.
And it's funny because, as a matter of fact, it doesn't only save energy, as in machines. It saves energy in fights and things like that. Because, for example, I bought your book from my bed. I was in bed, and I didn't have to spoil the beauty of the situation where I was, and I bought the book. Otherwise, I would have been going to the bookstore, and they would have said, no, we don't have that book, we don't carry that, wait until 7 days or maybe a month, and the Hay Festival would have passed, and I would have read the thing.
Actually, let me say, can I say one more thing about the energy, which is...
Oh, we're going to go still into energy, so This is very important because for David, he comes from the country that says, this is a fact from now, the United States represents 4% of the world's population. We account for 24% of the world's total energy demand, which is awful because they demand a lot of energy. And they say that it's computers and things like that, but that's not the reality. I mean, you have numbers that you're making more, demanding less energy.
Exactly.
And this is in the book. Also, if you check your bill, this is my energy bill, and it seems like the cheapest thing that you can have at home is a computer. I mean, everything else is very expensive, but here it says computer, one or two light bulbs. So obviously, even on the bill of energy, you should be looking at this and deciding that it's better to have a computer plugged to the internet and things like that than to clean your house. Maybe that's not a good idea. But here you have something else, which is books and what is happening.
Yeah, so it turns out that when I wrote this book, I wrote this book over the course of a few years about why the internet matters and how it will save civilization. And I decided in the end that I was only going to publish it as an iPad book, an electronic book only, exactly so that Pablo, a friend in Colombia, could just buy it from his home and friends all over the world could buy it from wherever. So the idea is, unlike my other books, this book does not exist in physical form. It's only electronic. And I decided I had to do that to keep it consistent with the theme of the book, which is moving bits, not atoms. And it's exactly because the internet is saving civilization that I decided to do the book this way. But I think we'll come back to that point.
Yeah, and the beauty of this is that he is telling us that one third of the trees that are cut are for printing purposes. And the need for these kind of things have raised 400% in the latter half of 20th century. So there's also working from home and even giving lectures on their spaces like Second Life.
Yeah, that's right. It turns out that working in your pajamas from home is not just comfortable, it's also really important for the planet. One of the ways that helps, I'll just mention, is with epidemics, returning to this previous topic, because when an epidemic hits a population, what it needs is for people to be close together. That's how an epidemic spreads. But the next time an epidemic hits, all we need to do is work from home, and that drops the density below the point for causing a pandemic, which is very useful. But it also saves a lot of energy. So how many of you use Second Life or have ever seen Second Life? Okay. Well, please start using Second Life. It's a way of meeting...
My ex-girlfriend came from Second Life in England.
But the journal Nature, which is one of the science journals, asked me recently to give a talk in Second Life. So instead of burning jet fuel to get to a conference and everybody comes to the conference, instead I gave a talk in Second Life with PowerPoint. Hundreds of people dropped in. I talked with them. I answered questions. And there was no energy. There was no extra energy burned for that. People from all around the world could be in the same place communicating with no jet fuel. And that makes a big difference.
And this is a beautiful one because you tell us that what happens with packaging?
Yeah, it turns out when you go into the store, even if you're just buying something small, like a jump drive, let's say, a little flash drive, you know, it has a big plastic package. And the reason, of course, is that they don't want people shoplifting that. So they have to put it in big packages. Well, now that things are being shipped more and more, you can have very tight packaging. It can be very eco-friendly. And so there's a lot being saved just in that.
So obviously it's going to be distributed using the systems that you told us, and this is the real price of energy. But then there's something quite interesting because he talked about diseases and what is happening with the medical and scientific communities.
Yeah, well, so here's what's going on. There are a lot of problems that are very difficult to solve, and of course some difficult problems bring down civilizations because civilizations run into problems that they're not smart enough to solve, right? Well, here's what's happening now in the biomedical community is something called crowdsourcing. ¿Cómo se dice en español?
No, trabajo en grupo, trabajo colectivo.
Okay. So the idea of crowdsourcing is you get tens of thousands of people trying to solve the problem, just people online. Why? Because a lot of people are online and they're not doing anything really important at that moment. They just want to play games or something. So what if you can get their game playing to solve a useful problem? So here's an example of a website called Foldit, which tries to figure out how proteins actually fold up. It turns out this is a very difficult problem computationally. And the best the best computer programs have a very hard time figuring out the answer. So this site turned it into a game. And they have 57,000 people trying to win points by folding the protein in different ways and looking for the lowest energy, the conformation that gives the lowest energy. And they get rewards and so on. Well, what happened is a paper was just published in the journal Nature with the best protein conformation ever found. And the authors on the paper were blah, 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 and 57,000 Foldit users. And that's who solved the problem, was this giant community of people. So it makes for a capacity now to solve problems that we never had before.
Something beautiful, and this is a side note, is that when you're reading David's book on your iPad, you can go into some more information, like the red folded sign that is in the first line. You can go in, and he takes you to places online that are very interesting. So he's able even to take us to websites, and these websites are like online and live, so you get the most up-to-date information from the relevant sites that he's showing us. And this is something that is very important in a country like ours, because we're a third world country, and there's a lot of poor people that don't have the way to do all the things of a proper job. And then we have cultivating human capital.
So here's the idea. Crowdsourcing is a terrific idea, and it works. But only about less than 1% of the world population is actually involved in crowdsourcing. And what that means is there are billions of people around the globe who simply don't have the opportunity to participate in solving these problems. Well, what we know is that we are going to confront very difficult problems in the future, and it would be very nice to have billions of minds involved in this. So what the internet does that's so special is it democratizes education. It opens up the doors of education to anyone, anywhere in the world. All you have to do, if you can get to a computer, you can get a free MIT education. You guys know MIT, the university? They put all of their courses online for free. This was several years ago. And then many other universities have followed. And there's iTunes University. There are lectures. There's something called the Khan Academy. There are hundreds of websites where you can get the top education for free. What are we seeing here?
This is Cartagena, and this is just the university. When we were growing up, we were being told he learned his things in the university of life. And I think what David is talking about is that any of these citizens of any city in Colombia is going to be able, if he goes online, to find the right tools to solve situations and problems on his location. He doesn't have to leave the city. He just have to apply what he learns in his city. And this is beautiful because this is an article that was in the Avianca magazine when I was taking here to Cartagena yesterday, and it's about the compromised citizens or citizens helping to solve things. So with these technologies, they go in front and they don't report a riot or a killing. They just show where a hole on the street is, so obviously everything starts happening. But this, you have to educate people to do this. So this is what you were telling about MIT, and this is India.
That's right. Oh, this is a picture of the Khan Academy, which is just one guy who started putting on videos to teach his nephew and his niece about mathematics and then chemistry and biology. And this site became so popular. It's the number one educational site online. He makes these 10 to 15 minute videos. It's all free. And he teaches every topic imaginable. Bill Gates now sends his children to this site. Everybody goes to this site. And it's so beautiful how, you know, because for every Barack Obama or Albert Einstein or Yo-Yo Ma, for every person that we see like that, there are 100 kids who are just as talented, that never have the opportunity for education. And now all that's changing.
And we're not talking about the elite. David talks about these kind of projects.
Exactly. So here's the thing. Okay, so you might say, well, it's not that easy because every kid needs to be able to get to the internet and that's not available for everyone. Well, there are... Oh, that's great. You've got an example. Okay, so this is a program...
El gringo no los conoce porque solamente consiguen en países en vías de desarrollo en el tercer mundo. Sorry.
Great. Well, this is a program that's called One Laptop Per Child. And the idea behind this is, let's make a really inexpensive laptop and spread these all over the world, millions of them, so that if you're a kid in rural Africa or China or anywhere in some little village, you can get a hold of one of these. They're simple. They don't have the bells and whistles of other fancy computers. But what they do is they open this up, this democratization of education, to everybody.
And what is beautiful is that they have the only screen that works in the dark and also under heavy sunset. The only thing that we need is a politician that helps this to happen in the country, because these could be taken to any little village. So the kids, where this technology exists, teach their parents how to use the web to get to this potential. But there's also the dark side.
Well, the dark side is the internet is so important to us now that there's this very important question, which is what happens if the internet goes down? So the internet has not gone down in its first 5,000 days, and some people think, oh, well, that means it could never go down. But that's probably not true. And so there are actually several ways that the internet might go down, and we're in big trouble if it happens. One of them is with these undersea cables. So it turns out that there are various what we call choke points, or places where the cables all come together. And if the cables get cut there, whole countries can lose their internet connectivity. This has already happened 8 times, where underwater cables have been cut. Mostly this has been off the coast of particular countries, Muslim countries. And so, you know, this is probably the beginning of underwater cyber warfare. But what it shows is proof of principle that this is one way that the net can go down if there's real underwater cyber warfare. Another way is with space weather. So when there are giant solar flares, this can knock out transformers and it can melt computer chips. The last big solar flare where this happened was in the 1800s, and it knocked out all the telegraph services. But now, with our dependency on the internet, if we have a big geomagnetic storm, we might be in really big trouble. So,
because you say that the next one is going to be 2012 or 2013. Maybe the Mayans were right.
The Mayans weren't right, but we will have a storm eventually. And so, and actually it's problematic that we're making the chips smaller and more dense, because that makes them more sensitive to gamma rays from the sun. So just as a side note, NASA still uses old computer chips. They use the big, fat, old computer chips because they're more robust against space weather.
Well, before going into questions, obviously the big thing is, why did he make his book as an app? And these are reports from Marketing Week, consumers of written word turned to tablets, and these are residents from the UK that have answered the question of how they are reading right now. And it seems that everybody that used to have books now is tasting the power of these machines. And more than Kindles and Sony readers, the thing is going to iPads and things like that. So these are the numbers. It's not making up. It's what is happening. Right now, people that had a Sony reader or a Kindle, as I did, moved into the devices like iPads, where you can see things in motion. I mean, when you got an iPad, things get completely different. But then, this is beautiful because the other book that David has co-written is about synesthesia. And I think the reflection here, or the idea, is that this mind situation is where you have two senses, like vision and taste, together, or you think about numbers and you see colors. I think what is happening right now in the publishing world and in the writing side, the ideas, is that everything is under the right boxes. So maybe these devices are going to become, are going to help writers to become synesthetic.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they are going to go above the novel, the short story, the essay. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I know when I was writing this book, it was very interesting for me because I was spending as much time as a writer as I was as a visual artist. So for every bit of text that I wrote, I was putting in pictures and visuals. I'm sure most of you can't see this from where you're sitting, but afterwards we'll give some demonstrations of it. But for me, it was a whole new experience for writing because it became a piece of art as well as a book. And so in that sense, it was very synesthetic for me. It was a whole new experience rather than just writing text.
And obviously, what is happening is that you don't have pictures anymore. This is a magazine, a British magazine coming from Virgin, and it's called Project, and this is the dude, that it's the actor Jeff Bridges, now the actor of Tron. And this is not a picture. This is a moving image. Photographers are using high-definition cameras right now, so they can deliver this. And obviously, the article is here. Because you can go, and then you have text and the images. So this is the change. This is what it is. So obviously, maybe using one of your book phrases, the knowledge he shared gave me my freedom after 50 years of isolation. Maybe some of you are ready to write the big Colombian multimedia novel, and you didn't have the right tool to do it. And that is what is happening right now, I think. Obviously, when they say this is only for developed nations, this is a study, and it seems like students in Florida have the same needs as students in Ghana or Luruaco or Manizales, because that is the situation right now. And I like to think like this editor, Peruvian editor, that says, I'm reading, leo el cuaderno gris de José Pla, una obra maestra de la curiosidad, de la digresión, de la ciudad y del retrato, y me pregunto qué hubiese escrito hoy si estuviese vivo. Tuviera 21 años, la edad en que empezó a escribir el cuaderno gris, y fuese un blogger. He's the editor, he's the publisher of a magazine called Etiqueta Negra. And I think this is the change of chip, the mentality that we need to accomplish. Because what we just had was a conversation, but this is the same kind of conversation I have with his ideas with this machine, because I can talk to you, send you an email, tweet you, do something else. I think these are artists of the past. And what the Beatles did and Michael did is completely different to what other artists like Pomplamoose are achieving when they make a show and they talk with the audience. And then live, they ask questions and they get immediate feedback. So I'd like to open the mic a second for some questions, if you have. Do we have a microphone to... Here.
Gracias. Aló. Bueno, yo veo que ustedes dos son usuarios de Apple. Y yo quisiera saber, en comparación con el Kindle, ¿qué ventajas o qué desventajas encuentran al uno y al iPad?
Thank you for that question. Yeah, the reason I wrote this on an iPad is because the iPad is interactive, and it's not just that you're reading pages, it's that you can actually interact with the figures. So I don't know if you can see this. I'll be able to show afterwards to anyone who's interested. But for example, when I'm talking about epidemics, here's a virus, and you can zoom in and you can understand what it looks like. And I have many figures in here that are three-dimensional interactive figures, and you can't do that on a Kindle.
Lo otro es que esto lo que te está haciendo es que te está pasando el papel, que el Kindle y el Sony Reader son puro papel, a elementos que pueden tener movimiento, sonido, interacción, color. Cambia la experiencia. And in the brain, it should be completely different to have multimedia.
Muchas gracias. Es una pregunta muy, muy corta, pero en el mapa que mostraron del mundo, Colombia parece verde, o parecería que estamos siendo por lo menos levemente vigilados. Eso me sorprendió un poco. ¿Por qué y por quién?
In the map you have the same color, but it's the same color as the US. You have the same color, like some level of control.
Censorship.
Yeah. But it's the same thing that is in the US. I'm going to show again the image. Meanwhile, you see? So they have it, we have it. But it's little.
Okay, yo estoy supremamente de acuerdo con compartir información. ¿Qué piensa David sobre compartir esa información y ese conocimiento bajo Creative Commons?
What do you think about creating, sharing this information on the Creative Commons?
Oh, I like that idea. Actually, I wrote this book for the iPad, and then what I'm about to do is put it out as an e-book, an EPUB book, and that way it's going to be everywhere. You know, it's actually a little bit, I don't know the answer to your question yet. It's a little bit difficult for an author to produce stuff. You know, it takes maybe a year to write a good book, and then to put it out for free is a difficult decision to make because it's not clear, you know, how one could keep a living going doing that. But Pablo and I have had a very interesting conversation yesterday about piracy, about people stealing books, and I guess you introduced it by that, and I'm in favor of that. I think there's just the right amount for an author where enough people buy my books and then enough people pirate the books to spread the information. And I think there's a sweet spot that's just right for that.
I think just to complement that, because it's related, obviously piracy helps authors. What we need to solve is how we are going to pay authors that we love. And this year, Facebook is going to start using Facebook money. With that, you're going to send some dollars to your favorite person, or it could be author. And I think that right now what they have is a worldwide audience. So obviously, he's not only selling to people living in Massachusetts or in the US or in English-speaking countries. He sold one book, and if you have an iPad, I really recommend you buy this Why the Net Matters app, book, because you're going to enjoy it and you're going to carry it. And one thing that is completely different from traditional printing is that you're going to be updating the book. What is that?
Yeah, so normally when I put out a book, that's it. I'm not allowed to make any changes. But because this is a piece of software, I can keep updating the book. I can push updates so that a reader of the book will say, oh, there's a new update, and there's new information in it. And I think it's especially important for a book about a fast-moving topic like this to be able to stay current, to stay evergreen. And that completely changes the concept of a book because now, it doesn't have to become outdated.
¿Otra pregunta?
Well, I want to know how likely it is to happen for the internet to shut down. And if what would happen if there are any plans for it?
¿Dónde estás para? Okay. ¿Cuál es la pregunta? Si quieres.
Bueno, en español. Que que si el internet se colapsa totalmente, ¿cuáles son los planes?
If internet collapses, what happens?
I mean, I think we're in big trouble if the internet collapses. So I have been in favor of... how many people have heard of the global seed vault in Svalbard? Has anyone heard of that? Okay, so there's... up in the northern part, just below the Arctic Circle, there's a big cement vault that contains all of the seeds of the plants of the world. So if there's ever a global catastrophe, we could recreate the crops, right? So I'm in favor of making an internet global seed vault, essentially, which is not simply a backup of the internet, but it's actually even instructions on how to build the internet, on how to rebuild it, how to generate electricity, how to build a computer, how to build the internet again. Because if we ever have a major disaster, like a nuclear war or a giant asteroid or something, it would be very useful if we didn't have to spend 10,000 years recreating that, but if all the instructions are stored somewhere in a mountain.
Maybe what is going to happen is that an Irish pirate is going to have everything, and there's going to be a second part of that book, How the Irish Saved, Again, Civilization.
Okay, wow. I guess we're done. Muchas gracias.